Welcome to the fifth episode of the Strength Academy podcast. Mundo here, once again joined by Grayson.
How's it going, guys?
And today we are going to talk about coaching philosophy, some of the things that we want athletes to kind of ingrain in their mindset, and some of our pet peeves as coaches, and then we're going to throw in another philosophy corner question. So, Grayson, so when I talk about coaching philosophy, I'm saying, like, in general, across the board, what do you want for your athletes?
Well, so I think excluding the obvious that I want people moving in a safe and technically sound manner, I'm kind of going to more focus on how I want people thinking about what they're doing. So, you know, I think it's really important for athletes to be really active in what they're trying to do. So instead of just kind of relying on us telling them something, but, you know, making sure that they understand why we're telling them that thing, and that even when we don't say, keep your elbows up, because we might not cue you on every single lift to remind you to keep the bar close, you still need to be actively thinking about that and actively trying to do that on every rep from the time that you pick up the bar to your 80%. You should be kind of trying to emphasize those things, because especially if you've been with us a long time, you kind of know what we're trying to get you to work on. So priming yourself when you're warming up to really kind of stay focused and intentional. So I think intention is really important in training. Okay. Like I really think that people, you know, a lot of times, especially if it's a day where you're just doing some powers, it's really easy to just kind of go through the motions. You're like, yeah, I kind of power snatched it.
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, you got it up overhead. You did a power snatch, but was it the best power snatch you could possibly do? And I think that's a really important thing for me.
Okay. I think my approach toward coaching is, I want athletes to be as self-aware as possible of what they're doing. So it runs along the lines of what you're talking about. My goal is to eventually get the athlete to almost coach themselves. And I'm basically going to be guiding them after that, at that point. So if the athlete knows where they went wrong, where they made a mistake, then they can correct it in that next rep. And I'll watch for that. I'll watch for the athlete. He's like, oh, I was kind of forward on that lift. And then, you know, they'll say, okay, I need to keep my chest more upright, or I'll remind them. But what I look for is consistencies in errors, or consistencies in good technique, and try to reinforce good technique and then diminish the inconsistencies. So that's why sometimes I'll ask people, oh, is this your last set? Because that's when I notice something that was happening over and over again. And sometimes they'll be at the end of the set, sometimes they'll have more, but the quicker I can recognize those things, the more time I can give them to try to correct them. So I'm constantly looking for the things that are showing up over and over again. And like I said, for athletes that are more advanced, they'll know where things kind of went awry. So I'll just give them a reminder. The cue is just a reminder of what I've already taught them, and it's something that maybe they just forgot, and, you know, because they're so used to doing it correctly over and over, they just forgot to do it, you know, that one time.
Yeah, I think you know, looking for what people are consistently off with is, from a coaching standpoint, kind of where you can really get a lot of solid work in is, you know, if somebody misses 65% behind them in the snatch and it was clearly just a fluke, that's, to me, that's not something that warrants a, you remember that you're supposed to hold it over your head,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't require a destruction of the snatch and rebuilding it. It's just, well, that was weird. Don't do that again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you know what you're supposed to do. You just did it a little bit off.
Right.
And that doesn't require, like, a whole, like, freak out and analysis of what went wrong. It's just focus more on your next set.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. But, yeah, so looking, you know, when we kind of build our supplemental workouts to kind of tailor the accessory work to those individuals, that's what we're always looking for, is we're looking for, okay, what does this person consistently have a rough time with when they're doing the full lift?
Right.
And then we kind of build those exercises around. And whether that's upper body strength or speed under the bar, we're always kind of looking for what is a thing that is the most consistently wrong in the lift and causing the largest issue within the lift. Which is kind of that idea of, you know, fixing the mistakes off the ground first.
Yeah. Yeah. From the ground up definitely is a good approach. And, I don't quote Mike Bergner very often, but like one of his, mentalities toward lifting was a majority of lifts are missed because of footwork, and whether that involves balance, whether it involves actually moving the feet and replacing them and being accurate with the foot placement and the jerk, things like that. I mean, that's where a lot of things go wrong, because if the balance in your foot position isn't good, it's going to throw off the rest of the lift. Whether it's from the floor or the hang position or the finish position, if you're forward, leaning forward on the dip and drive of the jerk, or your foot placement isn't where it should be as far as width and length of the split position, that's going to throw off a lot of stuff. So from the ground up is a good approach when you're troubleshooting somebody's, you know, lifting inconsistencies. So do you think there's any secret techniques or anything that people can do?
As many t-shirts as they sell on Instagram, I don't really think that there's one method of doing things, because you can look at the top international competitors from various regions, like Eastern Europe versus Asia, and you can see minor differences in how they set up, and you can see these kind of general differences. But if you look at what are they doing the same, there's a lot more that they're all doing the same than they're doing differently.
Right.
And when you start to think about the differences in limb ratios and body proportions, the height of the hips in the start position isn't a matter of a secret technique. It's a matter of how long your legs and your torso are.
Yeah.
So, you know, the way that we kind of, and like you were talking about footwork, I really agree that, and that's why when I talk to athletes, I try to really make most of it centered around where do you feel your balance in your foot? Because if it's, oh, I need to lean my shoulders further over, or I need to move my knees back, they're thinking about it as a disconnected thing. They're trying to make the snatch a pull the knees back off the floor, bring the bar to the hips, then extend, where they should really just be focused on staying balanced in the correct place in their foot.
Right.
And the rest of it will largely take care of itself. So when I cue athletes, I really like to have them focus on what it's supposed to feel like and where their weight distribution should be,
right,
rather than trying to overcomplicate things. Because as a lifter doing a snatch, I don't need to give you a 15-minute lecture on what a double knee bend is and how that generates maximal force at the top of the extension. Because that doesn't really matter for what it feels like for you,
right?
You know, and yeah. I want them to understand what they're doing, but in that moment when they're correcting, it's your balance shifted too far back. Keep your weight in the middle of your foot. You were too far back on your heels, or you were too far forward. So using balance as a way of, you know, helping them feel like, oh, I know what it feels like when I'm forward because it's shifting.
Right.
I felt a shift. Allows them to troubleshoot a little bit better. Because like you said, I mean, the goal is to eventually, you know, have them be able to say, hey, I've been feeling, well, one, give us more accurate feedback.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because if they know what they're supposed, what it's supposed to feel like, and they're like, I feel like I keep getting pulled forward, we can address that. And we have a better idea of what they're, if they have a better idea of what they're trying to do, we have a better idea of how to help them.
Yeah, I agree. And so I took my advanced USAW coaching course at the Olympic Training Center. And I had the privilege of watching the Olympians train at, you know, at the weightlifting facility when it was still open. And they trained with Zygmunt Smalsertz. And is that how you pronounce his name,
Smalsertz? That sounds about right. That's okay. As close as I can get.
Zygmunt. We'll just call him Zygmunt. So so a lot of the Olympians that were going to compete at the 2016 Olympics were there, and they were training, and I just noticed that a lot of them were pretty much analyzing their own videos themselves, and it goes with what Grayson said. They had enough self-awareness to know where maybe something was a little bit off, and they would record their lifts, look at the videos, and then they would give Zygmunt feedback so that he could provide them with corrections, or maybe, you know, a small suggestion, a cue to help them get back on track. And also, it seemed like like Zygmunt's job was to make sure that they focused on what they were doing when they were training. So like they weren't distracted, or, you know, there wasn't a bunch of maybe just things that weren't going the way they wanted to, and just kind of push them back on the track. And like I said, most of the lifters are elite lifters. They're Olympians. So they knew what they're doing. They know how to snatch. They know how to clean and jerk. They know the corrections because most of them are coaches themselves. But sometimes you just need that extra set of eyes and the ability to give that feedback to your coach, because you are aware of those problems, or you are aware of those imbalances, or just that maybe that small tweak in technique that you've kind of missed because you've just been doing it for so long. I think it just makes you a better coach and a better lifter if you have more self-awareness.
Yeah, and I think, you know, especially the longer you do something, the more in tune you are with what it is. And, you know, our lifters that I've been training for years at this point, you know, when we make a plan for the next competition, it's less dictation than it is when I write the program for, you know, our, you know, up and coming kind of team program, because right. They need to focus on fundamentals and getting it down and getting stronger. And we're addressing their weaknesses on those supplemental days. But when we have our people getting ready for nationals or American Open, I'm a little more open with that, where it's like, okay, so here's the things that we've done this year. This is what I think has worked really well. This is where I think your focus needs to be. What do you feel like you're lagging on? What feels off to you right now?
Right.
And it's a little bit more collaborative with that, because they've done enough training now where, you know, I mean, I think Tyler and I have been working together for almost 4 years, maybe.
Yeah.
Almost 4 years. And he now has like a pretty good feel of like, okay, well, when we do this, like, for instance, he always knows that he does really good when he gets some EMOMs in early in the training cycle.
Right.
And while that's not a tool I use for everybody all the time, I know that Tyler responds very well to that, and I take him at his word with that. So we use that into our training program. So we collaborate a little bit more. The more advanced you get, you can give us feedback. You can say, hey, you know, if you guys are on the training program right now and you're doing some supplemental work and you feel like it's really, really clicking, the next time we come around, be like, hey, that last time we did that, I felt great. And we'll take that into consideration and make sure that that's, well, one, still helping you, but we want that kind of feedback. You know, yeah. If something felt really great, like you really liked a particular exercise, let us know, because if it's really helping you, that's something that we can keep in the rotation. And if the opposite's true as well, if you're like, you know, I just don't feel like I can, like, this exercise really helped, I just got confused when I did it,
right. Then
okay, we can move to a different direction. But I'm a big believer in getting feedback from people.
Okay.
Because I feel like a lot of times if something's not working, or you're feeling overtaxed or too tired or too beat up, and you don't let us know, we can't know.
Yeah.
So I want the feedback.
You know? Yeah, that's true. I mean, you kind of want to know where people are, things are starting to beat them up too much. Maybe like the squats, there's too many squats. Oh, so do you like the idea of completing a program until it doesn't work anymore, or just continually trying new things? And like, how have you experienced success with that in the past, or maybe it didn't work out?
Well, so I heard this argument made on Weightlifting House the other day, and it got me thinking a little bit, and I kind of like the idea. I mean, if you think about Kendrick Ferris, did the same program for his entire weightlifting career,
right. And
went to the Olympics 3 times.
Yeah.
And he did the same 16 weeks, essentially, with minor variations, of course.
Yeah.
But he did essentially the same program and had repeated success with that. I think that if you have ADHD with your training, that can get a little bit hard.
Yeah.
But I try to do that a lot in our programs, in that we usually do a similar structure for squatting. The length of the program will be dictated with one competition we're going to go to.
Right.
But trying to keep things, I try not to change too much all at once. Where if at the end of the program we had a lot of success, I'll say, okay, well, what was one area that I felt like it didn't work particularly as I wanted to? And tweak something and then run it again. and see if that helped fix the problem or helped smooth things out a little bit. But, you know, we typically run a fairly similar squat program for most people just because we've seen that it works really well.
Right.
And the times that we've tried to do more intense squatting programs, like, do you remember when we did the Russian squat program?
Yes.
As a club?
Yeah, I do.
And, you know, while those things are kind of novel and fun, it was not as... It was either you got a lot of PRs out of it, or you couldn't finish. And I don't like doing, you know, trying these kind of crazy squatting programs. I tend to like to keep things pretty simple, and because complexity is not the same thing as effectiveness,
right?
Always, you know. Yeah.
And I agree with that. I think sometimes the simplest things are the most effective, and if you can just keep things flowing in a simple way and then just add on or take away things that aren't working, that usually turns out to be the best solution. And sometimes you have to tweak things for individuals, just like we were talking about, like accessory work for individuals gets programmed based on challenge areas. But if we notice that a lot of lifters are having the same problem, then the program gets developed in a way that's going to help cover that weakness across the board.
Exactly.
And so that is one part that is just, we found it works really well, and people continue to get better and better technically, not just as individuals but as a team. They all start to improve. And so let's move it in the direction of like coaching and pet peeves that we have. So for one of my pet peeves is, well, two of them. So the two main ones that I have are complaining and clarking. So if you're not familiar with the term clarking, it's derived from Ken Clark from the 1984 Olympics. And he would just pull the bar to about belt height and just drop it. He wouldn't even attempt to get under it. So that's where the term clarking comes from.
Which is too bad, because he was a great lifter.
Yeah, and exactly.
He just had a couple of high-profile bad meets.
Yeah, so we're talking about an elite Olympic weightlifter that would do this. And so that's why the terminology got named after him, just because it was so public. And it just stuck in the community. But so when people do it, to me, it's a failure to be confident in your ability to get under the bar. And it's not, there's a difference between you not being able to stand up at all with it and you kind of being afraid of it. And the difference is if you squat 140, like front squat 140, and you clean 80 kilos and that's your max, that's a problem. Like, the problem is not your strength. The problem is your confidence in your ability to get under the bar and stand it up. So that's, for me, it's just, you didn't even try. And I think more people have less tolerance for not being willing to try. And that's just across the board. I mean, it might not even have anything to do with weightlifting. If you don't even try, like, people really don't have a whole lot of respect for that. And so the second thing is complaining. And for me, complaining is just, it's not a venting of frustration or anything like that. It's just like, oh, you don't feel like doing it, or you don't want to do it, or it's hard, and you're just, you know, voicing something that you're gonna have to do anyway. So just be quiet about it. Just do it. And I know some people are more prone to it than others, but for me, that's a pet peeve. Do you have anything that kind of gets under your skin, Grayson?
Well, I mean, like, I can't say that complaining gets under my skin, because some of our athletes complain in ways that I find hilarious. So if Riley finishes a set of squats and then lays on the floor and yells about it for 10 minutes, I'm kind of okay with that, because I sort of think it's funny. But I can see how that's, you know, as an individual, like, that's a hard, you know, there's a line,
right,
you know,
yeah.
If you're complaining and you still did it anyway, to at the best of your ability, then that's fine. If you're complaining, so you're trying to half-ass it and skip abs,
right,
then that's the line for me.
Okay.
I think one of the biggest pet peeves I have is not taking warm-ups seriously. And that includes, you know, not loosening up and getting your joints warm and ready for the workout. But also, and in particular, what I was thinking of was when people do empty bar work and it's just sloppy and not at all how they would want to snatch. You know, like if you're doing your empty bar snatches and you're just kind of swinging it up overhead and like leaning over and letting your back round when you overhead squat, or like,
yeah,
you know, just not being as deliberate with the bar as you would be with 100%. Because if you don't start with doing it right, you're not going to build momentum into doing it right at your top set. So that kind of bothers me a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I think just chronically Instagramming between sets kind of bothers me sometimes.
Okay.
Because, again, it's, you know, for me, I don't mind if you have an Instagram addiction. I think everybody has a little bit of that going on. But if you are doing doubles and you hit one and you have two more sets left, I don't want you watching videos or reading memes in between sets. I want you thinking about what you're going to do on the next set. I want you to stay in the, like, stay in the moment, right? You know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, you got to, it's part of the, you know, idea of, like, when you're at the gym, you're practicing. So every single time you pick up the bar is an opportunity to practice that lift. And whatever the percentage is, whatever it's, if it's built to a heavy and do drop backs, your goal should be snatch the bar perfectly 5 times. Snatch 40 kilos perfectly. Snatch 60 kilos perfectly. And your intention on every rep should be to do the best possible snatch that you can. Because the top sets might only be 6 repetitions, right?
Right, yeah.
So if you're doing, you know, like the snatch clusters we did this week, where you're doing 2 sets of 3 reps with a break in between, if you only took those 6 reps seriously, you missed out on a lot of really valuable work.
Right.
It's like when people do this, here's another one, is when people do work from the hang and they don't do a snatch position deadlift to pick the bar up to their hips before they lower it.
Right, yeah.
So if people are going to do, you know, a hang snatch, and they just round their back and pick the bar up like you would never, ever pick up a weight, it's like you just missed an opportunity to practice your snatch pull.
Right.
Like, you got to do everything. You got to be actively trying to do the best you can at every exercise. And I think that sometimes, you know, distracting yourself on your phone can kind of bring you out of that, and you're like, oh, what was I gonna do again on this next one?
Yeah.
You know, so you're, and you end up waiting too long between sets.
Yeah, exactly. And you get cold, and yeah, your focus is towards something else. And so one thing we were talking about, and it's definitely what you were talking about with weights and building up the same way all the way up to the final lifts, is that you practice the weight at each stop, wherever you're stopping percentage wise or numbers wise, you're practicing those lifts. And if you practice in a way that's sloppy or, you know, inattentive or unfocused, why do you think that's not going to carry over to the larger lifts? Like, if you can't snatch the bar well with speed and precision, like, why are you going to snatch 100% well with speed and precision and good position, you know, timing. So this is practicing every rep like it matters.
Yeah.
So, and what Grayson is saying is that it's practice. You're practicing wherever you're at percentage wise, wherever you're at weight wise, you're practicing the lift. And you could be doing 1,000 lifts at 60% over a course of, you know, 6 months. And if you're treating all those reps like they don't matter, you missed out on 1,000 reps that could have been your absolute best, even though they weren't your max. So the only reps, if you think the only reps that matter are the top end sets or the reps where you get to go for 1 rep maxes or heavy singles, you're missing out on a whole range of practice to do it, you know, well up to that point.
Well, and if you think about it, you know, when you're training the snatch or you're training the clean and jerk, you're training the movement,
right?
Where you're trying to get the muscle memory of how to move through those positions in the snatch and get a good catch. or a solid lockout on your jerk. The movement is what matters, and the weight is a byproduct, right?
Right.
So if you're always concerned about, I need to hit this much weight today, or I'm going to feel bad about myself. But if you're just having an off day, maybe you're a little dehydrated, maybe you didn't sleep so well,
right.
I would rather see you do quality reps at a lower weight than force yourself to miss or do something sloppy.
Right.
You know, so thinking of it as, it doesn't necessarily, like, of course in competition, the weight that you do matters. But the way you approach that doesn't have to be, oh, this is 90, so I have to do it good.
Right.
No, I'm going to do these snatches really well. And if I'm snatching well, the weight on the bar doesn't matter. Because 80 kilos is the same as 100 kilos. This, ignore it. Don't focus on what the weight on the bar is. Focus on the movement. And if the movement is sound and your strength is improving, that's going to go up.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, detach from, oh man, I know this is 180 pounds and that scares me. Detaching from that and just being like, well, I know how to snatch and I'm just going to do the movement. The weight doesn't matter. I don't care what this bar weighs. I'm just going to move and snatch. And trying to focus on kind of detaching yourself from your expectation of what the weights should feel like or anything like that, and just trying to move as well as you can and execute the movement and not stress yourself out about whether it was 85 or 82.
Right. Yeah, and that's, I think that's one thing is whenever you're trying to learn something like a skill or something that requires a lot of technical, it's very technically difficult, you don't want to practice it like, you know, it doesn't matter. Like learning the guitar, you don't want to play scales in a sloppy way. You want them to be as precise and as focused as possible so that it sounds good, right? So you want it to be like that when you're lifting too. You want to practice it so that it's precise and as beautiful as it can be, no matter what the weight is. If you can snatch 40 kilos like you snatch 100 kilos, that's the difference between usually an elite weightlifter and somebody that's a beginner. Because if they can make it look the same no matter what the weight is on the bar, they've reached a level that's just, you know, beyond the normal person that's lifting.
And that's not to say that I think anybody ever gets it 100%.
No, of course not.
Like, you know, everybody's going to have breakdowns at certain points. Everyone's going to struggle with certain weights. But you'll get past those things a lot sooner if you're intentional with every single thing that you do in the gym.
Right. Yeah, and that goes for accessory work too. Like if you're not doing pull-ups the correct way, it's gonna start causing problems, whether it's an injury or it's just not as effective as it could be. If you're not doing the ab exercises and focusing on the exact area of the core that you need to be working on, it's not gonna be as effective as if you were doing it properly. And I think a lot of people don't take accessory work seriously, and that's probably why they have deficiencies in some areas of their lifts, just because they're not practicing it the way that they should be to make them stronger in those areas.
And you know, I think a lot of that comes down to it's just not as fun to do dumbbell presses in a half kneeling right. as it is to snatch. Like that's so it's kind of hard to like push yourself on some of that accessory stuff.
Yeah.
But the more, you know, I think, you know, bodybuilders kind of talk about it as mind-muscle connection, where you can really, like, when they're doing isolation work, they're trying to just isolate that one muscle group, and they're learning to really talk to that and get that firing and not compensating with other things.
Right.
And we're essentially trying to do the same thing when we snatch, but we're just trying to do it with every single muscle in your body
yeah.
all at the same time. So it's going to be a difficult thing to do, but trying to be really in tune with how you feel will yield benefits to your technique. It'll yield benefits to your strength, because if you're letting yourself squat sloppy or high, or it's just not like, you know, as you're not actively trying to accelerate when you stand up, like you're just moving as slow as you need to,
right,
you're it's not that you're not going to make progress. It's just that you'll get better faster if you focus on those things and right. try to really be, you know, deliberate with everything that you're doing.
Yeah. And you know, I'm not saying that it's going to be perfect. In fact, I advocate for progress over perfection. But if you're constantly aiming to do it as deliberately as possible, then you're going to make a lot more progress and get closer to that idea of, I guess, perfection. But and so it just goes back to the philosophy that every lift matters.
Yeah,
it really does. All right, so that's pretty much what we wanted to cover as far as coaching philosophy goes. And I know you had another philosophy corner question, Grayson. So
yeah.
Let's move into that.
So so this week's philosophy corner, we're going to be so let's see. I guess we'll start with the question, and then I can kind of lay it out. But how much of what you actually believe, and I mean believe in any sense, morality, ethics, you know, just meaning, how much of what you believe have you decided, actively decided is what you believe versus believe because you grew up believing that? How much of what you think is true is because society has told you this your life, whole life, and how much have you reflected on and actually chosen to be important? So the idea is, and I really like the, so Nietzsche uses a metaphor in Thus Spoke Zarathustra that I think is phenomenal. So he says that there are three metamorphoses of a human being. When you're born and you're an adolescent, you're what he calls a camel, where you're bearing a lot of load, and the load is the values and expectations of the society that you're in. Make money, work a job, this is what school looks like, this is what your career looks like, this is when you have kids, this is what you do on Sundays, this is what happens.
Right, yeah.
And that's all being forced upon you as a child because you have not yet made that decision. So when you're a camel, you're bearing the load of society and the values that they teach. And he says that the first metamorphosis is that the camel becomes a lion. So where the camel is just doing what everyone says they should do, the lion says, I'm going to do what I will. So the lion is essentially a rebellion. And the job of the person who is in the phase of their life where they are a lion is to defeat the dragon thou shalt. Okay. And on every one of his scales is a societal expectation.
Okay.
So it's essentially you reject everything that, so you're in open rebellion against what society wants you to do. And only after you've kind of thoroughly looked at those values and those things that people tell you are important and rejected them and saw whether or not they held any merit, can you begin to be what he calls the third stage, which is a child, which is instead of rebelling against, you create your own meaning, and you have that life becomes a sense of play and creativity and choosing what you want and defining your own values and morals rather than taking on somebody else's.
Right.
And I just think that idea is kind of interesting. So, you know, do you feel like there are things in your life that, you know, when you think about them, you're like, I never chose to believe that?
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to tell you a story. And I don't know, a lot of people probably don't know this about me, but when I was a teenager, well, my family, especially my mom, they've always been like pretty religious. She's always gone to church and things like that. So I kind of grew up involved in that type of environment. So when I was a teenager, I used to be involved in like a youth department, like a youth group that was part of the church. And so one of the popular things to do was, you know, to go to these events and try to commit your life to doing something in that religious community. So for instance, if you wanted to become a preacher, that was highly regarded. And if you committed yourself to being a preacher in like a foreign country, they call them missionaries, then that was even more highly regarded. So in my fervor to try to be accepted in that community, I had, you know, kind of asked if I could be like a preacher. So then I started training, and they, you know, said, well, this is how you go about it and things like that. But then I got to a certain point where I realized I didn't believe any of this stuff really. And, you know, I was doing it because I wanted to be accepted or to please my parents or because I thought it was what everybody else wanted me to do. And so when I got to a certain point, I said, none of this really matters. Like, all these people are just the same as everybody else. Everybody's in the same boat. Nobody knows anything more than any of the rest of us do. And you guys are going off things that, you know, you yourselves don't even question. And they don't realize that some of the stuff they think about and believe isn't really relevant. Why does it matter? So I got to that point, and then I went through that lion stage where I rejected everything. Nothing mattered. Nothing was important. I didn't want to believe any of it. And then that's where, you know, I kind of went off on my own. I joined the military. You know, I lived however I wanted to live and did what I wanted to do. And then maybe like 10 years later, as I got closer to the end of my enlistment, I realized that there is things that I do believe in and things that are important. And be more creative about taking responsibility for my own life and how I want to live it and what's meaningful. And a lot of the times we think that, oh, you have to have, you know, a house and have a car and be married and have children and the white picket fence to be successful. And I abandon all those ideas. Some of them are important. Yeah, I have children. I have two daughters and they're important to me. But I don't think the white picket fence is important. I don't think that I have to drive, you know, a Bugatti or a Lamborghini to be successful or even make a certain amount of money. And that might not be popular with the opposite gender in some cases, but, you know, if that's the case, if money is all that's important to, you know, that's not the person I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened to me in regards to that. So like, I think that people should question why they believe something, and if it sticks, it sticks no matter what it is for you.
Yeah. And that's just it, is you don't have to outright, you know, as an intellectual exercise, you should question everything that you think is true. But that doesn't mean that you'll always reject it. It means that you should challenge it and challenge yourself. And then if you find that that thing is a value that you do think is important, you can keep that. But now that value hasn't been forced on you.
Right.
That value's been chosen by you. And I think that's a very different thing.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
You know, so, I mean, because, you know, an example of one that I think is pretty clear is don't murder people is pretty,
yeah, probably
pretty sensible.
Pretty sensible.
So, but you could say, okay, well, I'll reject that. Maybe there are times that it's okay to just murder a store clerk and steal gas. You're like, well,
apocalyptic times.
That's still probably horrible for his family and their family's family. Okay, so I'm willing to say that murdering is wrong.
Okay.
You know, so, but, you know, the idea of, like, what success looks like, I think, is an important one of these things to me, where it's, I try to think of it as, you know, I want to do what I think is interesting and what I think matters, and I like the fact that I get to help people kind of find confidence in themselves, and yeah, that's more meaningful to me than making a ton of money or, you know, working in a job that, you know, is a 9-to-5.
Yeah.
If I need to work odd hours to do this weightlifting thing that I've, you know, kind of found a lot and built a lot of my meaning around,
right,
it's what's important, and the other stuff just kind of falls away. So the idea that, you know, there are these specific things that you have to do to be successful, or these specific things that, you know, people want from you, and you don't have to do what they want.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that it's important, and I love the metaphor, because I feel like we've all kind of had these things where, you know, you grow up and you feel a certain way, and then, you know, in that, you know, 18, 17 mindset, you look around and you see the absurdity, and you see, why are we doing any of this? Yeah, this right. Doesn't really make any sense. So you start to kind of reject those things, and I think that a lot of times that kind of leads to a rampaging nihilism of, yeah, I don't care about anything, and it can get a little self-destructive.
Right.
But I think that it's vital to have that, because if you don't go through that, you can't find what's actually meaningful to you, right, and what actually matters. Because when you throw out, you know, the ideas of family, or, you know, what code you keep with your friends, and like what the kind of morals you think are acceptable within a group, and you kind of live in a way where you reflect and you're like, I don't really like the way that I'm doing things, you can start to say, okay, well, what's really important to me? Okay, well, maybe loyalty is actually important and I need to put more energy into that. But I feel like I wouldn't have had as clear of understanding of some of the things that I do believe if I hadn't of just said, I don't, nothing matters.
Right, yeah.
And had that moment of, you know, existential crisis where you're just, I don't even know what I'm doing. Like, yeah, what, maybe I'll just get in a car wreck and this will be easier. Like, yeah, if you don't have those moments, you can't, you know, really say that your beliefs are your beliefs if they're just something that someone has told you to believe.
Right. And that's true. Like, I don't think that everybody should go through an existential crisis in their lifetime, but I think that people who do reach that point, like that, those stages, that stage in between the lion and the child is an existential crisis, because that's what gets you back on track.
Yeah.
And realizing what you believe and what's important. And so I think it's, I don't understand why people do some of the things they do and why we believe the way we believe things. Maybe it's just been that way for a long time, or maybe that's what we as a society in general have seen for so long that we don't know any different. So to be able to determine what's meaningful for you and what matters and what's important, really, I guess, is uncommon.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely, for those of us that have kind of found, you know, our thing to be, you know, fitness or the gym, right, or that sort of stuff, trying to explain that to people that aren't into it, nobody gets it.
Yeah, it's hard.
Nobody understands why you're spending 15 hours a week in the gym and constantly complaining about how sore you are just to try to lift more weight. And it doesn't really matter why they believe that. But what matters is, why do they think that drinking every weekend and, you know, having, you know, like trips to Six Flags or things like that are any different?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Why is it that what we're doing is weird? Doing is weird. And I don't understand you selling used cars trying to make more money than your neighbor so you can go to Disney World. I don't understand that at all. I think that's preposterous.
Right.
So nobody has it right.
Yeah.
Because there isn't anything that's correct.
Yeah. There's no perfect plan. There's no template that says this is exactly what, you know, what gives meaning and what doesn't.
There are as many ways to live as there are people.
Yeah.
And
I think it was Friedrich Nietzsche that said, you have your way and I have my way, but as for the correct way, it doesn't exist.
That, I wouldn't be surprised if that was him. I can't confirm, but
okay.
I like the quote though.
All right. Something that's paraphrasing. Don't quote me on that. All right. So I think that's
pretty good coverage. Yeah. I think, you know, think about what you think is important and why, and, do whatever you want, because it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Or it does, but it'll only matter to you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that concludes our fifth podcast. We will continue dropping these. So if you guys have anything that you want to, you know, us to discuss, or you have a philosophy question you want us to cover, just let us know. Otherwise, we'll see you next time.
All right, guys. Take care.
All right. Happy lifting, y'all.